This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And today on the show, this past weekend marked the five-year anniversary of the genocide of the Yazidi people of Iraq. This is when thousands of people were massacred or kidnapped and sold into sexual slavery by the Islamic State. And I am joined in studio by Matthew Travis Barber. He is a PhD candidate at the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago. And he is in the state to speak at a commemoration of the Yazidi genocide. Matthew, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Also in studio, Ezat El-Haider, who is a Yazidi person and an organizer of this commemoration and also leads up the CHIRA Global Development Organization, CHIRA meaning candle, meaning shining a light on what's happening. Ezat, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
The Yazidi people, this is an ethno-religious group of people, a very oppressed group of people from Iraq. Just to have a little history, a little bit of background, what does being a Yazidi person mean to you?
So first, we have three or four communities in Iraq, Yazidis, Sabil Mandaism, and Assyrians. So those are the indigenous groups that their histories are connected to the history of Mesopotamia. So being a member in that community, so being as a Yazidi is being faithful to my community, respect other communities, believe in living together. When we pray in our religion, we pray for all the world, including the Yazidi community, as a Yazidi person.
I know this is not ever going to be an easy question, but if you could give a brief history of the violence against the Yazidi people, because as genocides work, it's never just fine, genocide. There's a long history of violence and oppression.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and that is the case for the Yazidis. The Yazidi people are an indigenous religious tradition. They are not an Abrahamic tradition. They are a non-Muslim minority, and they've been targeted with prejudice and persecution for a number of centuries that flares up now and then. The attitudes toward Yazidis often have a religious basis. So within Islamic law, medieval jurisprudence in Islamic law, you have the idea that religions that preceded Islam that had textual scriptural corpuses like the Bible, like the Torah, so Christianity, Judaism, there's this idea that these religions were initially instituted by God, though later superseded by Islam, and therefore they're deserving of a status of protection under Islamic law. Mm-hmm. And this is why Jews and Christians and a few other groups have had legal protection under Islamic governance throughout history, even though they've had some issues and certain forms of discrimination as well. The Yazidis, however, have an oral tradition. They don't have a written scriptural text. So from the perspective of Islamic jurisprudence, they don't qualify for these protections. Now, in the pre-modern era, several centuries in the medieval period, that meant that Yazidis were targeted legally according to legal fatwas issued by the state for pillaging, slaughter, forced conversion, and mass enslavement. So Yazidi women would be kidnapped, taken to slave markets that operated in what is today eastern Turkey, sold. This kind of thing was common in the Yazidi experience. What this means is that everything that happened in this recent genocide in 2014 that the ISIS organization conducted, it had already been done to Yazidis in their history during the Ottoman Empire and so forth. And this type of action was based on the same type of theological arguments justifying this kind of slaughter of the Yazidis by religious terms. The problem or the difference with what happened in 2014 was more the scale because of modern weaponry. The Yazidis have never been so existentially threatened as what they were subjected to in 2014.
Ezat, you've been in the U.S. for 5 years. You got here in May of 2014. Like Matthew said, the scale of this genocide, it happened in August of 2014. You were brand new to this country, working for the U.S. military. When you are hearing about what's happening to your people in your country, what was it like watching and hearing this happen?
So I remember at the time we came from a picnic. I think we went to Detroit like some, we came back. And I opened the computer and my social media, my Facebook. And so some, you know, unbelievable acts are going on. So we thought at the beginning it could be a lie or something like that, but it was... They said, this area is gone, that village is gone, people are being killed, people are running. So we were so new, and me and my wife, we were a kind, you know, we were crying, didn't know how to ask for help. So it was very sad.
And that there's probably not a lot of help in this area. There's not a lot of Yazidi people in North Dakota. Within the U.S., there is a diaspora community in Nebraska that has about 3,000 people. Otherwise, there's a large community in Germany. How did you even just find people to connect with?
For the, like, when we came over here, We knew that there is a big community in Lincoln. We didn't know how far is Lincoln is from here. But through connections, through friends, we start to communicate with them and talk about it. So when first I came, I had a family, and there was a friend in Twin Cities that he advised me to come to this area because of the, you know, the safety, the education, those kinds of programs. And when the genocide happened, we didn't know, again, we didn't know anyone in the communities, but we start from that moment, you know, a kind of a passion happened that we have to raise the voice of our people to the community. That's why we started with the idea of Chira reaching out to Yazidis in other areas, like in Lincoln, in Winnipeg, and also to be more involved in the FM community to share our story with them.
And how did you get connected with Matthew?
Matthew, you know, Matthew's name is famous in the community because of what Matthew did for the Yazidi community during the genocide, before the genocide, during the genocide, and even after the genocide. Even today, it's that he made an identity for him in the Yazidi community, to a point that Yazidis are regarding him as one, as a member in the community. We don't look at him as a stranger. Elements or factors like Matthew in the Yazidi community is giving us motivation and in encouragement to speak out for our rights. What Matthew Barber say and people like Matthew Barber say, we as members of our community, especially in Middle East and Iraq, we cannot say it to the politics or to the government to tell them that this is our rights. This is our due. This is our rights and responsibilities. We cannot express those. That people like Matthews, they gave us that shot of motivation to fight for our rights.
One thing that Azat is referring to is the fact that you don't have norms of democracy or freedoms in northern Iraq, in the Kurdistan region, that allow people to criticize the government openly or talk about forms of oppression that they experience. And as a foreigner working in northern Iraq, I enjoyed a certain degree of privilege that the average Yazidi person does not have. Mm-hmm. And when Azat is saying that I am able to say things that Yazidi people are not able to say, he means that the kind of fear that silences a lot of people for very good reason, because of violence that is used to suppress voices and silence people, is something that I had a privilege to avoid and was able to speak a little bit more freely. Just going back for a moment to the question about what it was like to be here for Azat when the genocide began on August 3rd in 2014. Last night, you and I were talking, Azat, about how lonely you felt here, because you had just arrived in the U.S. 3 months before. You were in some other places, and then you relocated to this area in Moorhead. and you didn't have hardly any friends here in the community. You didn't know people. You didn't have a lot of connections to the American community, and you felt cut off from your own family and that feeling of not being able to touch anyone back home or help anyone, that kind of helpless feeling. And you were sharing with me kind of from your heart what that felt like and how you told your family, we have to go out. And you didn't know anyone here, but you made signs and went out to the street. I'd kind of like you to talk a little bit about that because it was so powerful to me to hear that.
Yeah, so, you know, when it was like a kind of, look, you know, the first three months, it was like a kind of a homesick also. You know, we came from, it was the first flight for us in our life, all the family members. We never hide, you know, because when you're talking about the Middle East and Iraq, you're talking about the privileged people and second or third class people who barely could find something to eat for their day. So that's why we were not between those people who could fly from a country to country or get like privileges to join a best education, like education-based colleges. And so that was a part of it. So when we were over here, everything was new. We didn't know anyone in this community. And suddenly that genocide happened. And we didn't know, like, you know, there's a couple of families in Minneapolis. When we first came for the first couple of weeks, we stayed with them for 2 weeks. They were the only people that we were trying to communicate with them and said, you know, we were crying and communicating with them. So we couldn't sleep at that night. And they were, So they were the only two families that we knew about them. Because we spent a couple of weeks with them. So we were beseeching to them to help us to find a way to let the people know that right now we are talking and a genocide is getting, like it's happening to our people. And they were also, they were beseeching us. They said, Izzat, please go and get some sleep because you cannot fight. because you cannot fight like that. You have to sleep so you could raise the voice of your people tomorrow. So that's why we started to look for some other ways to get to the community to find some ways to let the people to know what's going on. So we made some signs and we decided to get out, my wife, me, and four of my kids. One of them was a baby. And we didn't know where to go. So we went to Walmart first, believing, you know, because Walmart is one of the first places that we know when we come over here because we were going and, to buy food. So we went in front of Walmart, say, hoping that there will be some people come to listen to what's going on to our people. And unfortunately, like a member from Walmart came and said, you know, guys, you guys are not allowed to, you know, to make advertisement over here. It was not advertisement. We tried to express that to him, but anyway. So then we decided to come to the downtown, to Fargo. You know, we didn't know where to go exactly. So some people, they said, you know what, if you listen to me, go to the senator's office. So we went to the senator's office, and they welcomed us. We talked to them about the situation. We said, we are talking to you guys from now. People are being killed. My community are being killed. In this moment that I'm speaking with you guys, people are running. They don't know where they are running to. So they said, we promise that we will do our best. And they said also, you could speak to the media also. They gave us a number. We communicated with that number. And the person told us that I can't come to your house or to your apartment so we could talk more about it. So I still have the video from that. Time. So he came to our apartment and we did an interview. Then we put it on social media. And so it started, the idea of Shira started from that moment. We felt like in that moment, we all, as Yazidi members, we were feeling, we always felt guilty of not doing much to make the right change that need to happen. Even today, we have to do our best to make the right change. Because like even today, there is still, even the genocide, my community cannot express their opinions, cannot speak freely, cannot be a part, a real part of the let's say the democracy that we are talking about. There is no representation. There is no opportunity. There is we have a program over here at Shira called Community on Race. But when you're talking about race in U.S. comparing to the race in Middle East, the race that we have over here is a beautiful piece of cake over here, that the one that we are talking about, comparing to the race that we face it in back in our country. So just think about this: when no matter whatever you have, if you do not have connections with some of those ideologies that came after Saddam, if you do not have connections with them, or if you are not speaking their languages, you would never be getting to any points. You would always be crushed, or you would always be pulled back to not to express your opinion, not to do anything in your community.
Matthew, you mentioned that you were able to speak out because you are a foreigner and you are white and you're from a rich country. And that was 5 years ago. In 5 years, have you seen a change at all in acceptability of speaking out? Is it still dangerous for the Yazidi people to speak out?
It is still dangerous for the Yazidi people inside Iraq to speak out about what happened, but we have made some progress. So some of the problems for the Yazidi people today involve actions on the part of local governments that are inhibiting the recovery of the Yazidi people after the genocide. ISIS was the main actor that performed the violence, but the ISIS presence in the Yazidi homeland of the Sinjar Mountain region has been eliminated now for several years. And yet the Yazidis are still unable to go home. They're still living inside camps and tents for displaced people 5 years later. In my opinion, this is a very criminal thing. This is a great injustice. We know that the Yazidi people have been subjected to genocide. That genocide has been recognized by the United Nations and a number of governments around the world. This conflict has produced Iraq's first Nobel Peace Prize winner. This is enslavement survivor Nadia Murad. And yet the government in Baghdad has been extremely neglectful to help restore administration and security to Sinjar so that Yazidis can go home. Mm-hmm. Now, the Kurdistan Regional Government, which is a federal entity within Iraq but that has its own security services, its own military forces, and its own administrative apparatus, they have even gone a step further to deliberately obstruct the Yazidis from returning. This is because the Sinjar area is a disputed territory that they wish to control. They don't want to let the Yazidis go home until they can control it. So they've implemented economic blockades over the past few years to prevent Yazidis from taking reconstruction materials home. They have closed roads preventing Yazidis from traveling to Sinjar during certain times. There has been some attention from human rights groups on these abuses. Mm-hmm. And yet Yazidis inside Iraq still feel very afraid to speak out about them. Even Yazidis who are here feel afraid to go public about a lot of the abuses that they have personally experienced if they still have family members living in Iraq, because they're afraid that their family members will be targeted. When you're living in a tent and your food and subsistence comes through international humanitarian organizations and your camp is controlled by a secret police apparatus, you feel very vulnerable and very fearful to talk about these kinds of abuses. Mm-hmm. Members of the secret police, which are called the Asayish, Kurdish secret police, they will simply make a threat, a verbal threat to a Yazidi family, and Yazidi families feel very powerless. Most people have no connection to power there. They are farming people, rural, little access to education, a lot of illiteracy. So there's often a sense of pervasive intimidation that Yazidi people experience. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, the work that we've done through advocacy over the past several years, when I say we, I mean myself and Yazidi organizations that I've worked with, we've been able to bring a lot of attention to these abuses. We've been able to ask organizations like Human Rights Watch to document some of these problems, and a lot of that has taken place. So we've raised a lot of awareness about this. And I think that has also given courage to some Yazidis to speak out as well, but it's still difficult inside the country.
We're visiting with Matthew Travis Barber of the University of Chicago, a PhD candidate in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations, and Izzat El-Haider, who is a member of the Yazidi community, who has been in the United States, started working with the U.S. military, has been here for 5 years. We're speaking about the five-year anniversary of the Yazidi genocide. And Matthew, Izzat mentioned visiting with U.S. senators. And in the previous administration, there were U.S.-led airstrikes, and you are working with the current administration. How would you characterize the United States government's role in this conflict?
Well, the United States bears great responsibility to assist the Yazidi community. When the U.S. coalition invaded Iraq in 2003 and deposed Saddam and the system of governance that was in the country at that time, the Yazidi community offered hundreds of its young men to serve as translators for the U.S. military. So the Yazidi population was an important ally to U.S. forces during this conflict that our country waged. And no Yazidi person ever killed a single U.S. soldier. Opposition to the U.S. occupation never came from the Yazidi community or from most other minority communities. So there is a responsibility of reciprocity that the U.S. owes the Yazidi people when they are subjected to this plight. The other thing that's important to think about is the fact that the instability that has allowed terrorist organizations to proliferate inside Iraq was largely brought on by the U.S. occupation. Saddam Hussein had a tremendous system of control and security in the country, despite its heavy-handed, oppressive, authoritarian character. It nevertheless kept a strong guard against terrorism. There was not the proliferation of extremist groups that we saw after the U.S. invasion. So the fact that our country created the security vacuum that allowed terrorist groups to grow and target communities like the Yazidis, communities that also helped us during that conflict that we at times recklessly waged, creates a huge obligation, I think, to help the Yazidis. Now, in terms of how well we've done to fulfill that obligation, I would say it's been mixed. Right when the genocide began, President Obama ordered airstrikes, which were very helpful in keeping Islamic State forces from overtaking the Sinjar Mountain itself, which became a refuge where a lot of Yazidis from the nearby towns were fleeing. So Yazidis were being killed in the towns around Sinjar, and they fled to the mountain. The airstrikes prevented jihadists from ascending that mountain and killing people on top. So this saved hundreds of thousands of lives, in fact. However, the U.S. government was reluctant to go a step further and perform operations on the ground that could have saved hundreds of Yazidi girls and women from sexual enslavement. At the beginning of this crisis, you can imagine the kind of organizational capacity that it takes to kidnap 3,000 women and girls in a single day and then distribute them through networks where they can be sold in slave markets. This isn't something that just happens immediately. Those women were kept in large groups in towns very close to Sinjar, sometimes for weeks and months before they were gradually distributed into Syria, into Mosul in Iraq, and other towns. During that time, we begged the U.S. administration, Department of Defense, State Department, intelligence agencies. We spoke to everyone in Washington who would listen. We had meetings in the White House. We had meetings everywhere. We begged them to take action and perform some operations to save groups of women, sometimes kept together by the hundreds. These were very viable rescue operations. They were often guarded by very few jihadists. And unfortunately, we weren't able to make a convincing enough case, I suppose. It's something that I think I'll carry with me for the rest of my life, because we watched the window of opportunity closing as those women were taken out of Sinjar. And we would tell the officials that we were communicating with in Washington, you have to act now if you're going to save them. And it didn't save them. And that was a emotionally grueling period for everybody involved. And it was scarring, in a sense.
You're listening to a conversation with Azat El Haider, who founded the Chira Global Development Organization after ISIS fighters slaughtered thousands of Yazidi people in Iraq. And we're also visiting with Matthew Travis Barber, a Middle Eastern scholar at the University of Chicago. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I disagree with almost all of what the Trump administration does these days, but if that's their position to allow reimportation of prescription drugs, it's something that I have long supported and think ought to be done.
That's former North Dakota U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan responding to the recent announcement by the Trump administration to allow the reimportation of prescription medication from nations like Canada. Dorgan has worked on the same issue when he was in office 20 years ago. Dorgan says the escalated price of a drug such as insulin is a total disgrace. He says Americans are angry with the government, and the cost of prescription medicines is one reason why.
They think they're not on the side of the people. They're on the side of the pharmaceutical industry, or they're on the side of the people with the big bankrolls and deep pockets. And so it's why people are angry. Well, look, if the Congress, Republicans and Democrats, have any brains at all, they'll decide that they better respond to the interests of the people here. This is not rocket science.
While in office, Dorgan had teamed up with the Wyoming Republican Senator John Enzi to create a bill allowing reimportation of medicines. He says while the votes may have been there to pass the bill, Senate leadership refused to bring it to the floor. And a North Dakota legislator who proposed a red flag law in the 2019 legislative session says she is optimistic about the future of such a law taking effect in North Dakota. Carla Rose Hansen is a Democratic representative from Fargo. She says that while her red flag law bill did not pass, it did have bipartisan support. She says there were 10 Republican co-sponsors on the bill, including the Senate Majority Leader. She says red flag laws have been implemented in other states looking to save lives by proactively addressing gun violence.
It's basically a legal process that can save lives by enabling families and law enforcement to act before a warning sign escalates into a tragedy. So it basically allows people to intervene during a crisis if they're worried that a person is in danger of either hurting themselves or hurting other people.
Hansen says, for example, law enforcement is very well trained in de-escalating situations, but they are not removing weapons after those situations are resolved. She says the process would allow law enforcement to petition the court to have firearms removed from the possession of someone exhibiting warning signs pointing to violence while they get treated.
We've been very lucky that we have not had a mass shooting in North Dakota like the ones that occurred in Texas and Ohio, or like Sandy Hook or Parkland or Las Vegas or so many others. But if there were concerns that a person was threatening to do in an active shooter situation like a school or a concert or a church or another faith organization, we could use this as a way to prevent that horror from happening in our state.
Hansen says 15 states have passed red flag laws, and just this morning, Ohio's Republican governor proposed something similar. She says she's encouraged about more conversations taking place on a national level on how to address gun violence. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we have been airing a conversation with Azat El Haider, a Yazidi man from Iraq who worked for the United States military and founded the Chira Global Development Organization in response to a brutal attack on Yazidi people in Iraq by ISIS fighters, and Matthew Travis Barber, who studies the Middle East at the University of Chicago. Matthew was the keynote speaker at a recent presentation commemorating the five-year anniversary of the attack. We continue that conversation now.
I think another problem is also at the political level. The Yazidis, like I mentioned, have been kept in camps now for 5 years. They're being prevented from going home by tactics implemented by the Kurdish government and also the neglect of Baghdad. We've begged the U.S. and other Western governments to apply pressure to those entities inside Iraq to make it possible for Yazidis to go home. And we think it's essential that the world, having recognized this as a genocide, now help the Yazidi people to go home. What we see, though, is that instead of getting into that difficult political mess and really fixing the root cause. Governments would rather earmark a certain number of funds for humanitarian aid that goes to the camps and then pat themselves on the back and say they've done their part. And that aid often simply maintains a status quo. It normalizes a context of displacement where Yazidis are now semi-permanently inhabiting these camps and wondering whether they're ever going to be able to resume their lives. And I will tell you, it's very viable for them to return to Sinjar, rebuild their lives, and survive in their homeland. But that's not happening because of this failure to act.
Izzat, I do want to get back to you and talk about healing. But before we do that, Matthew, do we know where those women and girls are now?
So of the Yazidis that were – let's see.
I mean, I know you mentioned mm-hmm. some of the places that they'd been displaced, but 5 years on, are they still alive?
About 6,500 Yazidis total of all ages and genders were abducted in the initial period of the genocide, in addition to several thousand that were killed. Of that number, a little over half were female. So over 3,000 women and girls were taken into slavery. Of that number, a little over half have returned to freedom, okay, either through escaping on their own, through very sophisticated rescue efforts, through ransoms, through prisoner exchanges. So different mechanisms, but still many have returned. Over 1,500 have returned. There are still a great number that are missing. Mm-hmm. That means that even though the ISIS organization has been crushed and broken, there are still women all over Iraq and in parts of Syria who are living in the homes of ordinary Arab families who still, quote-unquote, own them. It's a word that I don't like using because I don't believe a human being can truly own another human being. But that's the reality. Some of those women find it difficult to return and reintegrate into their community because they've now given birth to children that the children of the jihadist captors who have kidnapped them. And if these children are now 4 years old, 5 years old, sometimes it's very difficult for them to leave those children behind. Mm-hmm. So I think some of them are going to forever remain a part of the new community that they've become part of. They will not speak Kurdish. They will speak Arabic. They will maintain a Muslim identity. Their children will be raised as Muslims, and they will remain part of that community. I think other women will emerge over long periods of time, maybe 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. We may see women that suddenly reemerge from captivity. Some of them may be sheltered from even knowing what has happened in the outside world. They may not know that ISIS is gone. They may not know anything. It depends on what type of environment they're being kept in and what access to information they have.
Mm-hmm. Izzat, Matthew mentioned that when you're living in camps and there is just maybe your basic food and sleep needs being met, and that's maybe, it's very difficult to concentrate on healing. And you are, of course, still very far geographically from this situation, but the organization that you run, the CHIRA Global Development Organization, and again, CHIRA means candle, and what you aim to do is to continue to shine a light on this situation. What are you able to do to help people heal from this?
Beside what Matthew said, it's not only the basic human needs. We have the human trafficking going on. We have, you know, there's different things. There is diseases, malnutrition. Mm-hmm. Different things are going on in those camps that Yazidi are living in them. So we, at CHIRA Global Development Organization, it's a new organization. As I mentioned at the beginning, it started from the day, you know, the first day of the, let's say the day after the genocide. Mm-hmm. We realized that we all have to do our best to get more awareness to what's going on to our community and how to support them. So that's why we at CHIRA, we are doing three things that we are doing in the community. First, we are educating the FM area community about who are Yazidis and what happened on August 3rd, 2014, and what do we need from the FM community and the support that we needed from the FM community to support us to help us to make this genocide to be acknowledged at the level of the international community. The second thing is we are communicating with most of the Yazidi leaders and organizations, and because we have some concerns even over here in U.S., like as Yazidis, you know, we're talking about very, you know, a life over here than in Iraq. It's a kind like different. So that's why we're trying to have a good connection between us, Yazidi leaders and organizations, so we could communicate from time to time. Mm-hmm. First, to serve the community in U.S., so to build a professional community, communicating, serving our kids, building our ideology, and doing a lot of programs in our community over here. And at the same time, building a strong Yazidi lobby, because we believe that if you want to stand for what's going on in Middle East, you have to have a power in U.S., a Yazidi power in U.S., so we could speak out for what our people over there, they cannot say. So over here, we are living in a democratic country, and we could express anything that's going on over there. That's one of it. The other one is I was talking to Matthew also last night, that we trying to build that leadership that we all could come together. Like when we all come together, we could do more than what we are doing, for taking more programs to our people in the refugee camps, building their areas, as Matthew mentioned yesterday. And, you know, fighting racism over there, giving opportunity to our people, representation, and making those people to feel the moments of freely express their identity. Because even today, like, as we mentioned before also, after the genocide today, we are prevented to express ourselves as Yazidi also.
Mm-hmm. Have you been able to go back to Iraq?
Not yet. Today is 5 years, so we applied for our citizenship. We will have our interview. But sometimes, I was talking to Matthew that I'm sometimes putting some posts on my social media. And so to see all the side, to see what's exactly going on, because some people, they cannot express that, and also to encourage people over there. And, you know, because if we take it as a community, then we would have, you know, we would be a power that others cannot fight us as individuals. So those are just, if not because of those obstacles, I would really like to go and volunteers sometimes at the refugee camps.
So you mean that because of some of your posts on social media where you talk about the abuses, it makes you afraid
to racism,
go back?
Yes, the racism, exactly. Mm-hmm. The racism that's been used against the Yazidis, the representation that's missing, the identity that's taken from the Yazidis, the refugee camps that are in a bad shape, the obstacles between the Sinjar area and the Kurdistan and the Hashd al-Shaabi, the ideologies that had been built after the genocide. We have more than, at the time of Saddam, we know that there's a one dictator. He was, he was a very bad dictator. But and we all were suffering under his regime. And when we got rid of Saddam, we were so happy that all of us, we would have like our democratic country. But unfortunately, after Saddam, we had like all the systems or all the ideology that come after Saddam, they just want to build to their ideologies no matter what. No, they don't care about human rights. They don't care about the minorities. They don't care about the opportunities. They just want their own ideologies to be bigger and bigger and bigger, like what Saddam was doing.
Mm-hmm. What will be the first thing you do when you do get to go back?
The first thing, you know, I missed Lalish, so I want to go to my temple first. So that's, you know, and the families. But I want to go to do some classes and course for building some youth leaders in the Yazidi community, so they could speak out for what they want. And, falling that barrier that had been built, that this is sacred, you are cannot talk about it, that, you know, moving a lot of barriers that we're hoping to, if we had the opportunity and ability to go and support those people.
Matthew, what first drew you to studying the Middle East?
Well, I had visited the Palestinian West Bank in my early 20s to visit some humanitarian organizations that an organization I was volunteering with here were supporting through fundraisers. So I went to the West Bank and I started to understand a little bit more about what Middle Eastern society was like. I became interested in the Arabic language. It was really amazing. It opened my mind to a region that I knew very little about. And after that, I went back to continue studying, to volunteer. I taught English. I've been able over the years to visit almost every country in North Africa and the Middle East. So it's really connected me to the region in an incredible way. And it's helped me to become aware of some of these deeper issues facing certain communities like the Yazidis. I first visited the Yazidi community in northern Iraq in 2010, and I went back after that to do research among the Yazidis, and this was all before the genocide. And then when the genocide began in 2014, I was living in northern Iraq. Mm-hmm. So Azat was here, brand new in Minnesota, feeling disconnected from everyone back at home who was suffering, and I was also not in my country. I was on the other side of the water, and I was watching this flood of displaced Yazidis coming out of Sinjar into the city of Dahuk, where I was living 3 hours away. Mm-hmm. When I saw this community going through this trauma, and this is a community that I was already connected to and had been for several years, it affected me very deeply, and it immediately gave me the sense that I really had to get involved and do what I could to help. I remember that first day when Yazidis were flooding in. I went into a little Yazidi village near Dahuk where suddenly tens of thousands of displaced people were all just gathered in the center of the town. And a man walked up to me and he said, "Are you working with the UN?" And I said, "No, I'm not, but I am writing down the stories that people are telling me and I might write some articles." And he said, "Well, I'd like to tell you what happened to me," and he just burst into tears. And what had happened to him was that when they fled their village, when ISIS attacked earlier that day, he was in a different part of his town from where his little daughters were. So as everyone was fleeing in different directions, he didn't know where his family was, and he still didn't know till that moment. He wasn't sure if they were alive, if they were captured. And that began to, I think, connect me to the reality of these types of scenarios. We hear about them a lot in the news. People talk about them, but we don't know exactly what they look like firsthand. And I began to understand how people lose each other in context of genocide because you don't have a chance to plan for it. It's a surprise when it happens. Mm-hmm. And people are running every different direction, and suddenly your whole life is just unraveled. So from that point until now, I have been working with Yazidi people and organizations, doing a lot of advocacy work and humanitarian work, pushing many different aspects of the genocide response. I took 1 year's leave of absence from my PhD program to go back and lead a humanitarian organization in northern Iraq for 1 year, 2015 and 16. It was a Yazidi organization, and we created many new projects to bring medicine to Yazidi people, to provide supportive services for women that had been rescued from enslavement, financial support, emotional support. We did a lot of educational projects. We built a school. Mm-hmm. We did genocide documentation work. We wrote the first report of Yazidi mass graves in Sinjar. So we documented the locations of the mass graves and mapped them. there are mass graves all over the Sinjar area full of hundreds of bodies of Yazidi people that were lined up and shot or beheaded. So it's a very difficult situation. It's a traumatic situation. But when you're able to give people hope, even a little bit, in such a dark situation, it really makes a difference. People are very resilient, and sometimes they just need a little bit of support. And it can feel overwhelming when you see the scope of the need and you feel so powerless to make a difference. But if you just help the person in front of you, you are making a difference. And organizations like CHIRA, Ezzat's organization, are also making a tremendous difference because they're educating Americans here about what's going on and getting people involved. And I would encourage people in Minnesota and North Dakota who are interested in the Yazidi situation and want to learn more, just contact CHIRA and speak to Ezzat and get involved. There's a lot of volunteers from the local community here that I met yesterday at the memorial event, and I was very impressed. And they really care about Yazidi people, and they're doing a lot to help. Some people do fundraisers. Some people get school kids involved. And there's a lot that people can do.
And you can find that organization on Facebook, and CHIRA is spelled C-H-I-R-A, and it is called the CHIRA Global Development Organization. And Ezzat, one last question here. Matthew said to provide hope and to provide healing, no matter what is helpful. That is what you do. You were awarded a human rights award for the work that you do. What is your ultimate goal with CHIRA?
You know, we as Yazidi members, what we lost in our lives, we are hoping that we make a good education for people, people from all communities, not to be vulnerable to those moments. So that's why we ask CHIRA. CHIRA means a candle, and candle lightening the community. And we always defend people from different communities. We ask, members of the Yazidi community who are still going through a genocide. But at the same time, we are stretching the hand of help to the people who need our help from other communities. We have different programs also beside working on the Yazidi case. We have some programs in the community that we do to bring more, education to the community, bringing all the pieces of the community together making more mind, kind of more professionality and mindfulness in the new American community to make what we have as I always believe that U.S. is a beautiful country, so we always trying to bring that mindfulness and communication to make U.S. to be more beautiful for all of us.
Matthew Travis Barber with the University of Chicago, a PhD candidate in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations. Thank you for your time today.
It's been a real pleasure.
Ezzat El-Haider of the CHIRA Global Development Organization, an organization that you founded and were recognized with a Human Rights Award for your advocacy and activism. Thank you for sharing your story today.
Thank you so much.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Prairie Public is proud to present the live storytelling event, The Moth, November 14th at the Fargo Theater. Tickets available now at Tickets 300 or online at jadepresents.com.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 6th. While today we take rural mail delivery for granted, that was not the case in 1909. On this date, that year, there was exciting news for Beach, North Dakota. The Golden Valley Chronicle announced that the Postal Service had approved 3 rural routes for the area, covering 28 miles. Free mail delivery was instituted for city dwellers in 1863. 27 years later, in 1890, there was still no rural delivery, even though that covered 65% of the population. One farmer wanted to know why city dwellers got fancy home delivery while taxpayers in the country did not. John Wanamaker was the Postmaster General from 1889 to 1893. He thought it made sense to deliver mail directly to people living in the country. He saw economic benefit as businesses would have a means to expand markets. Farmers would be able to stay abreast of important economic news if newspapers could be delivered. Wanamaker also noted that people who lived in rural areas paid the same amount for postage, yet received inferior service. He proposed a plan for rural free delivery, which would become abbreviated as RFD. In 1893, Congress authorized $10,000 for the program, but the new Postmaster General did not implement it. He said it would cost at least $20,000. The appropriation was increased to $40,000 in 1896. That got the ball rolling, and within a year, there were 44 routes in 29 states. But many rural areas were still left out, including most of North Dakota. Organizations like the National Grange and the National Farmers Congress pressed for an expansion of the program. And so it was that Beach, after 14 years, finally got rural delivery. And rural mail carriers did more than deliver the mail. They served as a traveling post office. They sold stamps, money orders, and registered letters. They delivered mail on horseback or by buggy. In 1929, the post office determined that improved roads allowed for a switch to motor vehicles. But in some areas, like much of North Dakota, roads were not greatly improved. Carriers still preferred the reliable horse. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Dakota Datebook finally has a book, and we're going to launch it, quite literally, with a sunset riverboat cruise. Join Prairie Public aboard the Lewis and Clark Riverboat. We'll set sail from Bismarck Saturday, August 24th at 8 p.m. You'll be first to be able to get your hands and lay eyes on this treasure trove of North Dakota history. The Dakota Datebook book, prepared by a University of North Dakota practicum and the UND Digital Press, features specially selected datebooks for each day of the year. So practice your best meadowlark whistle. That was good. And get aboard the Lewis and Clark with Dakota Datebook founder Bill Thomas and State Historical Society Director Claudia Burr. Saturday, August 24th, we'll set sail at 8 p.m. Central. Tickets are $15 in advance, $20 at the dock. Go to prairiepublic.org to reserve yours now and to place an advance order of Dakota Datebook North Dakota Stories from Prairie Public. Or you can call 800-359-6900. So sail the majestic Missouri with Prairie Public. And celebrate a collection as unique as the state whose stories it tells.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, a look at the life and times of Judge Charles Amidon, wartime hysteria, and the Espionage Act of 1917. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.